Today at Reader's Corner, Nicholas Pucola, author of The Fire Is Upon Us, James Baldwin, William F. Buckley Jr., and the debate over race in America. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. On February 18th, 1965, an overflowing crowd packed the Union at England's Cambridge University to witness an historic televised debate between James Baldwin, the leading literary voice of the civil rights movement, and William F. Buckley Jr., America's most influential conservative intellectual. Nicholas Pucola's The Fire Is Upon Us is the first book to tell the full story of the event, the radically different paths that led Baldwin and Buckley to it, the controversies that followed, and how the debate and the decades-long clash between the two men continues to illuminate America's racial divide today. Dr. Pucola is the Elizabeth and Morris Glixman Chair in Political Science at Linfield College in McMinnville, Oregon. In addition to The Fire Is Upon Us, he's also the author of The Political Thought of Frederick Douglass and the editor of The Essential Douglass and Abraham Lincoln and Liberal Democracy. His essays have appeared in scholarly journals and The New York Times, Salon, The Baltimore Sun, among others. He joins us today by phone to talk about his latest book, The Fire Is Upon Us. Nicholas Pucola, welcome to Reader's Corner.
How you doing, Bob? I'm really excited to be here.
Great. Well, Nick, let's start with the title of your book. It's obviously a spinoff of the real title of Baldwin's most famous work, the one that probably did cement his reputation as a civil rights thinker and leader. It was called The Fire Next Time. Your book is called The Fire Is Upon Us. Tell us about The Fire Next Time, that is, the context in which it was written, the times in which it was written, and what that did to Baldwin's reputation at the time.
Yeah, so The Fire Next Time was published in January 1963, and it was actually the product of a couple literary wheels getting set in motion in about 1961. Baldwin had been invited to write a series of pieces for The New Yorker magazine about travels through Africa. And Baldwin, for various reasons, delayed his trip to Africa, was having a hard time conceiving of what that assignment would look like. And he began working at the same time on an essay on the rise of the Nation of Islam, which he had been commissioned to write by Commentary magazine. And so various things are going through his head. He's also working on various autobiographical pieces, and they all come together in this long 20,000-word essay that he called Down at the Cross. And it was published in The New Yorker magazine in November 1962. And it's this long essay that combines a kind of story of Baldwin's upbringing. Primarily, he focuses on his teenage years in Harlem. He weaves that with the encounters he has with the Nation of Islam in the early 1960s with Malcolm X and with Elijah Muhammad, the leader of the Nation of Islam, and then just general reflections on the moral history of the West. And it's a piece that's really a powerful call for the country to change its ways or else. The Fire Next Time is really, what I like to say about it is it's not a wish, it's a warning, right? Baldwin is trying to warn people that unless we sort of live up to the promises that we've made and, in our founding documents and so on, unless we live up to the promise of, liberty and justice for all, there's going to be trouble. There's going to be greater trouble than the country's already seeing. And so Baldwin publishes that piece in The New Yorker, and then he publishes another piece around the same time in the Progressive magazine that's a short letter to his nephew that's meant to mark the 100 years since the Emancipation Proclamation. And those two pieces together make up the book, The Fire Next Time, which, Baldwin's literary star was already very high when that book is published, but that really takes him to this level of international fame that made him one of the most famous writers in the world by the time he meets Buckley at Cambridge.
And let's go back to those early, early days of Buckley and Baldwin. They're both New Yorkers, but that's about the only thing I guess they have in common other than the fact that I think each of them came from a family of 10. Is that correct?
They both came from large families, yeah. The one of the really fascinating things about this book as it came together was that these two individuals born in the same city just about a year apart from each other. But as I say in the beginning of the book, they may as well have been born on different planets. Baldwin's born in Harlem in 1924, Buckley in 1925, and they both come from these large families. They both come from religious families. They're both guys who are from a very young age fascinated by language, by words, the power of words to change the world, but they are in radically different environments as they grow up. Baldwin is his family in Harlem. He's the oldest of nine children. They grow up at the margins. They are, he says, the most defining fact about my parents is that they struggled to feed their kids. And so he describes in his fictional writings and his nonfiction writings what it's like, what the world looks like through the eyes of somebody like him or somebody like his father or someone like one of his siblings, living at the margins of society. And Buckley, on the other hand, is born, to tremendous affluence. His father is a real estate and oil man who's made and lost and regained fortunes by the time William F. Buckley's born. And his mother comes from old money in New Orleans. And so he grows up in very privileged circumstances. His family has this very large estate. They have a number of estates during his childhood, but the primary estate where he lived was called Great Elm in Sharon, Connecticut. And it's this 47-acre estate where, of course, they have live-in servants and so on, and also a vast array of tutors teaching them everything under the sun. And so the kind of physical circumstances under which Baldwin and Buckley come of age are an important part of the story. I say that it's not, their circumstances growing up don't determine their views, but they shape their views in important ways. And of course, the things that they're taught by their parents are also central to that story as well.
And I wonder if you could touch on that. His mother, Buckley's mother in particular, since this is a book about race and race relations, there seems no question that Buckley had to be influenced to some extent by the way his mother viewed the issue of race.
Yeah, and in the Buckley household, I mean, the sort of general worldview that the children were taught, there were, kind of two major parts of it. One was a sort of devout, conservative brand of Catholicism, and also a political doctrine that they called individualism. And individualism was a kind of catch-all term for the Buckleys that was meant to communicate their hostility to any form of collectivism, communism, socialism, the New Deal policies of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And the Buckleys were also taught to believe in hierarchy. Essentially, William F. Buckley Sr. and Aloise Steiner Buckley believed in hierarchy. They believed some people were fit to rule and others, were fit to be ruled. And they had their sort of belief in hierarchy was thoroughly racialized. So they had servants, people of color, working in the home, and essentially what Buckley's siblings report about their parents' views is that they were, the Buckley children were taught to believe in racial hierarchy. They were taught to believe that some people are racially superior to others, but they were also taught to believe in a kind of humane hierarchy, that their responsibility as those who were superior was to take care of those who were inferior, and there was a kind of mutual obligation there, a kind of, noblesse oblige, kind of a feudal view in some ways that they were taught as children. And so Buckley's mother, was unapologetic about those views, and she, held those views from everything I was able to gather in the research throughout her life. And Buckley really, what really bothered him as he sort of came of age intellectually was a conflation of that kind of racial view that his mother held and taught him with a kind of a racial view that is rooted in animus, And so Buckley tried to draw a distinction between different kinds of racism, and he really did not want to think of what his mother was doing as racism, but as a, a view that was, not as racially progressive as others, but he thought was defensible on some level. And as I argue in the book, he really defended that view, at least in the period that I'm covering the book, throughout his life, though in different ways.
Well, they're certainly polar opposites. There's no doubt about that. Did these two ever meet before going over to England and debating at the Cambridge Union?
I was unable to find any evidence that they met prior to the encounter at Cambridge. The two instances that at least that I was able to discover in looking at all the archival material and everything else is that they met at Cambridge and they met a few months later on the David Susskind's open-end television program in spring of 65. And they were both invited to Truman Capote's famous black and white ball, and Buckley did attend, but Baldwin did not. So that would have been another opportunity for them to cross paths. But I wouldn't be shocked if, there was some other instance where they came across each other on the New York social scenes. They ran in mostly different circles, but they had one of the things that was fascinating as I did this, the research for this book is that because plenty of people still living who knew in some cases both of them and, in a couple of cases, actually managed to develop friendships with both men. I interviewed Norman Podhoretz for the book. I interviewed the great journalist Dan Wakefield for the book. These are people who knew both of them. And so there were individuals in the kind of New York intellectual scene that both Buckley and Baldwin had occasion to spend time with. So, yeah, the only evidence I have, though, is that they met on these two occasions to engage in this sort of intellectual combat.
You're listening to Nicholas Bukola. He is the author of The Fire Is Upon Us, James Baldwin, William F. Buckley, Jr., and the Debate Over Race in America. So it's February 1965, and they're both invited to the Cambridge Union. Let's put this setting together. First of all, tell us about the Cambridge Union, what it is, and you might mention its president, who I guess you must have talked to as well. Peter Fullerton must still be around.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Cambridge Union is the world's oldest formal debating society. So the union had just marked its 150th anniversary just before the Buckley-Baldwin debate in 1965. So it's this old debating society has been around for all this time, and essentially it primarily was a student debating society. So most of what happened in those days at the Cambridge Union where you'd have students debating one topic or another, sometimes very serious political topics, sometimes a little bit more frivolous, kind of pop culture topics. But this was a debating society where, at the 150th anniversary that occurred just prior to the Buckley-Baldwin debate, you had the Archbishop of Canterbury there, you had members of Parliament there. And in many ways, the Cambridge Union, like the Oxford Union, was, thought to be a kind of training ground for, elites in British society, right? It was modeled after the House of Commons. So when you look at the, the video of the debate online, it looks like you're looking at a sort of miniature version of the House of Commons. The students go in there and they debate these topics. And in the 1930s, the union adopted a new rule that allowed the students to invite distinguished orators, who could discuss issues of great importance. So these were people that would be sort of guest speakers. And they had guest speakers prior to that, but this sort of became a more normal practice in that era. And they would invite in people who were, distinguished intellectuals, politicians, to have these discussions with them. And so in the case of the Buckley-Baldwin debate, you have two student speakers, one on each side. So the motion before the House was the American dream is at the expense of the American Negro. So there's a student speaking on Baldwin's side and a student speaking on Buckley's side. The backstory of how the debate came to be was kind of my first puzzle to solve, because there really hadn't been any thorough explanation of how did this happen? How did these two guys get together that night? So one of the ways I did that, as you mentioned, is by interviewing people like Peter Fullerton, who I was able to, my wonderful undergraduate students at Linfield College helped me track down these students who hosted the Cambridge debate. They were in their 20s back then, so those who are still with us in their 70s now. So my students helped me track down these folks, and I was able to interview them for the book. And I have the opportunity later this month to go visit and speak at the Cambridge Union and spend time with Peter Fullerton and others who were eyewitnesses, which will be really an amazing experience.
Wow, that will be cool, and have a chance to see that room close up. I might remind our listeners that this debate is on YouTube. I was pleasantly surprised to go on and find it and see these two gentlemen up there making their case. Could we address just for a moment how usual the rules of engagement were compared to what you might find in a college debating society today? It's been a long time since I was a high school debater, but we had rebuttal periods, as I remember. And in this debate, it's a little different in that these two guys speak and that's it. And whoever gets to go second, I guess you might think, could have an advantage.
Yeah, the exact details of the way this particular debate was structured, a lot of that was, Fullerton couldn't remember, exactly why it was structured the way it was, because there were a lot of different formats that they used in those days. But one of the things that seems clear is that Baldwin's agents, his publicists, his handlers were very, first of all, they tried to cancel the debate. They didn't want it to happen. A week before, Baldwin's agent sends a message to England canceling it, but for various reasons that didn't happen. But one of the things I think is clear based on the evidence I was able to find in the archives is that Baldwin's handlers were worried about Buckley getting under Baldwin's skin. Baldwin's agent in one of the great pieces of correspondence I found in the Baldwin archive was, he says that Buckley is a master at getting under your skin, so in order to deal with him, you have to be cool. And he said, Jimmy is never cool about the world's problems. So he's kind of worried about the prospect of his client, who at that point is more famous than Buckley, is this international literary celebrity, going on this international stage, televised. It's going to be televised in the UK and then eventually on American television. He's worried about the prospect of Baldwin losing his cool with Buckley on television. So I think that's one of the reasons why the debate is structured as it is. You have each student gives their speech, and then you have Baldwin deliver his speech, and then Buckley deliver his, and then the vote happens. And so there is no substantive back and forth. And I think that is probably a result of various, you know, kind of behind the scenes negotiations that occurred prior to the debate. But the two, I should point out to listeners that the YouTube recording, the BBC recording, is absolutely must watch. You know, I definitely recommend everybody check it out. It's just so dramatic, and it just draws you in terms of the drama of that moment. At the precise moment they're there, we're in the midst of the Selma campaign, and you know, it's just sort of the heat of that moment in terms of what's happening in American politics, international politics, is really, I think, captured in the scene. But I think one thing that's worth noting is that the BBC recording is edited to fit within an hour. And so what's missing from the recording is, first of all, the student speeches are edited down considerably, but also Buckley's speech is edited down considerably. So Buckley actually spoke longer than Baldwin. Baldwin spoke for about 24 minutes, and Buckley spoke for 29. And one of the things that's cut out of Buckley's speech, I think, that's really fascinating is all the questions Buckley did get from the audience. So although there was no formal rebuttal period, like in the House of Commons, members of the union could stand up and be acknowledged by the speaker for points of information and questions. And there's only one of those that's captured in the BBC video, but there's about, I think, five or six in the full recording. So one thing that we were able to uncover by interviewing those Cambridge students was we found, you know, what we think might be the one existing copy audio recording of the full Buckley and Baldwin speeches. So those are included in the audiobook, and the transcript is included in the print book as well.
So Buckley wasn't the first name that came to mind when these Cambridge Union students were trying to figure out who they wanted to debate James Baldwin.
Right, yeah. And so Peter Fullerton, the sort of genesis of how the debate came to happen was that Baldwin, the paperback version of his third novel, Another Country, was being published in the UK. And his publicist tried to arrange, you know, as much, he wanted to saturate the media landscape with James Baldwin for a week and in and around London. And so he contacted the Cambridge Union early in 1965 and asked if he could set up an author event for Baldwin at the Union. And Fullerton, who was only, he's an undergraduate at that point, but he says, you know, quite bravely to the publicist, he says, no, I won't host an author event, even for someone as famous as James Baldwin, because this is a debating society, but I'd be happy to host Mr. Baldwin to participate in a debate on the themes of his writing. And so the publicist agrees to that, and then the details are to be worked out. And so, yeah, they have this really big challenge in a very small window of time. I mean, this was early, so this is in January of 65. The debate ends up happening in February of 65. So Fullerton and the other union officials have to figure out, who can we get to debate James Baldwin? What will they debate? And Fullerton's first idea is just in the wake of the Goldwater election. And, of course, Goldwater was famous for many things, and one of them was voting against the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So Fullerton's first idea is to reach out to, you know, sitting U.S. senators and see if anyone would be willing to come across the pond and debate James Baldwin. And he doesn't remember precisely who they invited, but he says that he remembers rejection after rejection. So he thought that, you know, Goldwater was a likely suspect, somebody like Strom Thurmond, who was strongly pro-segregation and anti-civil rights. He thought that was a likely suspect. But he gets rejected by all these folks, and one of his fellow union officials, another student named Michael Tugendhat, had spent a little bit of time in the United States in 1963, and he had met William F. Buckley. And it was one of these things where, you know, at some point in this process, he says to Fullerton, hey, there's this guy I met over there, and he's, you know, at that point, Buckley was not well-known in the U.K. He would eventually become kind of internationally famous soon thereafter, but he, you know, Tugendhat says he's a star debater, he's one of the leading conservative polemicists, he's a leading supporter of Goldwater, and, you know, he would be, I think, sort of the perfect fit for this role. And so they reach out to Buckley, and Buckley, as fate would have it, was on his annual ski vacation in Switzerland, where he would go and ski and socialize and write a book every year. That was his tradition. And they reach out to him, propose, you know, debating Baldwin. Buckley had already made very clear in print that he had a lot of problems with James Baldwin's worldview. And so Buckley was always up for a debate and was eager to share the stage with Baldwin and to criticize him. And so that was the process. And I think that Elise Fullerton, it seems like from the correspondence I was able to find in the archives, the resolution was presented to Buckley. The motion was presented to Buckley before he agreed. So he says afterwards that there were certain things he would not have agreed to debate, but that the way it was framed, he thought was, you know, he could participate in good conscience. So, yeah, that's kind of a little bit of the backstory. And I get into a lot more detail in the book about how this thing came to happen.
So who won the debate?
Who won the debate? So the two sides have their chance. And when the vote happens, it's 544 in favor of Baldwin's side and 164 in favor of Buckley's side. So Baldwin's side wins that night pretty overwhelmingly. And I should point out that the Cambridge Union, that group of, you know, of students was actually, in British terms, fairly conservative. You know, and I give various examples in the book about the kind of conservatism of that group. That same union had, you know, not too far in the past before the Buckley-Baldwin debate, had, you know, had basically, you know, voted against the idea of revolution in South Africa. They had voted in favor of keeping the conservative government that was in place in early 65 that was thrown out of office by the British public. So the students were sympathetic. It was clear very early on that they were sympathetic to Baldwin. The spirit, the zeitgeist, you know, was clearly in favor of the kind of black liberation struggle. And so Baldwin won the night. He won the night by a substantial margin. Buckley says it's the largest margin he ever lost any debate by. So that was that was a significant moment in his history as well.
I'm Bob Kustra, host of Reader's Corner, and today you're listening to Nicholas Bukola, the author of The Fire Is Upon Us, James Baldwin, William F. Buckley Jr., and the Debate Over Race in America. Of course, the two examples you use are happening to the country those students are citizens of, and they're listening to two guys from another country debate similar propositions. One could make the argument that in this case, what's good for the goose is not good for the gander. And so they decided that, you know, yeah, we don't want South Africa to get to become free. But on the other hand, America really needs to deal with its South.
Right. And Buckley makes this argument, you know, and he does this a little bit implicitly in his speech. And this is something that I think is not captured particularly well in the BBC recording that is captured well when you hear the entirety of Buckley's speech, is that he does try to point out the hypocrisy, you know, of these British students. And he certainly does that in print after the debate. You know, so soon after the debate, Buckley uses his newspaper column, you know, on the right to sort of explain what happened. You know, what happened at Cambridge, you know, happened. And he does think that there is this kind of hypocrisy. There's this kind of jealousy, he thinks, of, you know, the British of their you know, sort of younger cousins across the pond, and as he puts it in one of his pieces. And so, yeah, Buckley spends really, I mean, the rest of his life, you know, he writes a lot about the Baldwin debate, and he tries to explain it in terms of the sort of hypocrisy of that crowd, the biases of that crowd, sort of a desire to affirm the identity of James Baldwin rather than take the argument seriously. So, yeah, Buckley devotes a lot, he spills a lot of ink reflecting on Baldwin, which was, you know, obviously an important part of the story that I try to tell in the chapter I have after that explains the aftermath of the debate, you know, and it includes Buckley's run for mayor of New York City soon after the debate and so on.
You know, I guess we all, as we look back on events we've been a part of, sometimes lose sight of what really happened, and maybe we mischaracterize the way things are. I certainly have done that. And in this particular case, Buckley, as you say, spending the rest of his life trying to explain why he lost this debate to Baldwin, has seriously misrepresented a couple of things that go on. In fact, that's the reason I went to the YouTube version, because I wanted to see what happened. Why don't you share with our listeners the two areas where Buckley walks away telling a story that really didn't happen in those debates?
Yeah, it's really interesting. And the Buckley's kind of recollection of what happened is flawed in a couple of fundamental ways. I mean, one kind of really obvious thing that's significant is that Buckley repeatedly in writing and in speeches after the debate says that Baldwin received a standing ovation before he uttered a single word. And that's just not true. I mean, you know, we have video evidence. And of course, you know, all these eyewitnesses who disputed as well. And so Buckley, I think in his mind, he thought it was true. And it was sort of, it captures the sense in which our imaginations can kind of take over. He remembered that night primarily for the ways in which the biases of the audience were so strongly against him that he had no chance, and that this is really, the debate was not about substance, it was about this sort of symbolic politics. And so that's one really interesting misremembering of what Buckley presents over the years about the debate. The other example that at least the eyewitnesses were unable to verify is that Buckley says later on, he writes this book called On the Firing Line. It's mostly reflections about hosting Fireline, the television show that he started in 1966, soon after the debate. But he includes a little vignette about the Cambridge debate in that book. And one thing that he remembered there was that one of the students assigned to his side in the debate broke ranks, and so was so moved by Baldwin's speech that he switched sides. And it's unclear what Buckley had in mind there. I think, you know, based on what I've been able to gather, so after Baldwin and Buckley deliver their speeches, there were three short speeches, like of just 2 or 3 minutes each, given on each side by other students, and those were there's no recording or transcript of those that I was able to discover. I was able to figure out who gave those speeches and talk to a few of those folks. But I think that what Buckley might be remembering is that the student who invited him, Michael Tugendhat, who I'm not sure exactly what Tugendhat's politics were at the time, but I think thought of himself as more conservative. After the debate, Tugendhat actually writes to Buckley he writes a kind of critique of Buckley's position, and Buckley writes this very detailed rebuttal of Tugendhat's critique. And so I think there's a sense in which Buckley maybe felt, a kind of sense of, the person who was like the key to his invitation there ends up, kind of turning on him and thinking that his view is wrong. And they have that exchange is really fascinating. And it was interesting to me just how important it was to Buckley. I mean, he took the time to write, this single spaced, I think it's 2 or 3 page long rebuttal to this student who criticized his speech at Cambridge. And this is an extraordinarily busy man, So, I mean, the fact that Buckley was willing to do that is I think captures, why this was a really important encounter for him. And I should point out to listeners in that 65 mayoral run, Buckley uses Baldwin, he uses especially his second encounter with Baldwin later in 65 as a kind of key part of his stump speech, So Baldwin had already been an important kind of symbol of, things that Buckley thought were, wrong with the country prior to the debate, but he really, his position in Buckley's mind as an important sort of political symbol is really enhanced by this experience that he has at Cambridge and later when they debate in New York and, mm-hmm. and later in 65.
When it comes to Buckley's views on race, it's hard not to put them in the category of racism. When it comes to that, in all fairness, looking at Buckley's entire life, there is some change and development there. In 2017, Politico wrote a magazine article that was basically about how Buckley had changed his mind on civil rights. And I have to admit that I hadn't even kept up and was a little bit surprised. I guess George Wallace, the Birmingham bombings, the Birch Society. He even took on Ayn Rand for Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead. Could you comment on, again, I know that's not what your book is about, but in fairness to a man's entire life, I think it is good to point out that there was definitely a change of mind here and a change in views by the time, he reached the end.
Yeah, Bob, I think that's a really important point. And I try to address this a little bit in the epilogue of the book. The narrative of the book really, it kind of wraps up the sort of substantive part of the book in late 65. And then in the epilogue, I talk a little bit about some of the things that happened later in the 60s and the legacies of Baldwin and Buckley. But yeah, I mean, this is an important point. And the Politico piece you point out was written by Alvin Felsenberg, who's written a really good political biography of Buckley called A Man and His Presidents. And yeah, and Felsenberg and I have a sort of disagreement and interpretation a little bit about this. I mean, one thing that's important that Felsenberg does a really nice job demonstrating are the ways in which, Buckley did evolve over time and took some more progressive views on race later in the 60s and the 70s and through the end of his life. And toward the end of his life, he's asked a number of times if he has any regrets, and there I sort of give a thorough, accounting of what he says, in response to some of the criticisms of the things he had to say about segregation and so on. in the book. And I think that one thing I discovered in looking at the evidence is that while it's certainly true that Buckley did evolve in important ways in the ways that Felsenburgh and others have argued, it's also true that he's never really able to fully repudiate, you know, the views that he had in the 50s and 60s on race. And in part because I think he really believed that he was right as a matter of principle with some of the views that he took, and that he sort of acknowledges that the sort of slow, organic evolution up from Jim Crow, as he put it in one interview late in his life, that he hoped could happen, you know, kind of naturally without, you know, federal intervention. He sort of recognizes late in life that he was wrong about that. But he's never really able to say that he should have acted differently in the period in which he was playing this really important role in shaping the conservative movement. So my argument in the book is that, you know, what we have to do is certainly we need to understand the full scope of Buckley's life to get a sense of him as a man and his legacy. But what's really important if we're going to make sense of political history and try to understand, you know, what we can learn from, you know, stories like this encounter between Baldwin and Buckley is in this period, right, when these individuals are playing such an important role in shaping history and shaping opinion, how did they react to the political events unfolding before them, and how did they think through those events? And, you know, even if later on in life they came to decide they should have acted this way or that, there's something really important we have to learn about the way they respond in the moment to these political situations as they arise. And so I try to argue in the book that, and I try to do this in, you know, as painstaking detail, and the book is already very long, but it, you know, it is actually longer before we, you know, got to this last version. But I try to really provide readers with an up close, slow motion explanation of how these two individuals are thinking through this history. And in the case of Buckley, you know, it's very clear that he does evolve over time in a variety of ways. I mean, I try to point out ways in which by 65, he's, you know, he clearly sees that, you know, he's been opposed to Brown v. Board school desegregation. He's opposed to the Civil Rights Act, opposed to the Voting Rights Act, opposed to most of the things Martin Luther King is doing. By 65, he sees that he needs to adapt, you know, the position of intransigence he's taken on civil rights. He's on the wrong side of history. He kind of sees that he's losing all these battles. And so he adapts his politics to kind of a more subtle kind of politics of racial resentment, where he really celebrates in a lot of the mid-60s writings the idea of white backlash, that you know, so okay, civil rights, you know, the civil rights movement has gone this far and we must accept that, but it should not go further, you know, into, you know, housing and into school, you know, school busing to achieve racial balance. So I try to show the ways in which Buckley does adapt over time, and certainly as you point out, later in his life, you know, he takes various positions that we might even identify as liberal on some racial questions. But I think that it's still important that we get a sense of this history and that we understand, you know, how he responded. And one of the things I point out in the book is that putting these two guys together, Baldwin and Buckley, obviously the debate gives us, you know, gives me as a writer, you know, this opportunity to do that, right? You know, because in many ways they're an odd couple. But one of the things I really thought was powerful about the book is that Baldwin is somebody who provides us with such a powerful lens through which to reflect on, you know, identity, morality, and power. And this is true of Baldwin looking at Buckley, but it's all Baldwin. One of the things I like about him is that he doesn't let anyone off of the hook, right? He's as critical of somebody like William F. Buckley as he is of somebody like Robert Kennedy. And he's, you know, I point out books in the book ways in which he, you know, was critical of Malcolm X and critical of Martin Luther King and for various reasons. So Baldwin is somebody who's always interested in forcing us to really think through the question of who we take ourselves to be as individuals, as members of communities, as members of nations, and how our sort of construction of identity leads us to treat other people. And that's something that I think is, you know, when Baldwin is using that lens to examine Buckley, I mean, we really get, I think, a really clear sense of, you know, how to understand what somebody like Buckley is up to and how to make sense of how racial politics or any sort of any political situation, it really comes back for Baldwin to this question of identity and how we sort of try to formulate identity in ways that will give ourselves a sense of meaning, but often that sense of meaning comes at the expense of the dignity of others. And I think that's one of the really powerful legacies of this story, is that I think Baldwin provides us with a really powerful and important lens through which to think about morality and politics.
Well, our brief conversation here, Nick, leaves out a number of chapters of your book that I think are really fascinating. I mean, you've rewritten American history, recent American history, using this lens of racial politics of the 1960s, but at the same time it reverberates right through our culture and society down to the present day, and it's the reason why I think our listeners ought to pick up a copy of The Fire Is Upon Us, James Baldwin, William F. Buckley Jr., and The Debate Over Race in America. Nicholas Ukola, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Bob, thank you so much. And I want to say one thing Baldwin and Buckley had in common was a love for books. And so I really think they would appreciate the work that you're doing promoting reading. I mean, books have this power to connect people across time and space, and they're more important than ever. So I really appreciate the work you do.
Great. Thanks so much, Nick. Nice to be with you today.
Thank you.
Next week, an encore presentation of our interview with James McLaughlin, author of Bearskin. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.